Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from UR subscribers
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
You're listening to WEVO, Concord, Manchester, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, in Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and it's time to do the roundup. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. And this week, House lawmakers in New Hampshire gave preliminary approval on legal recreational marijuana, and the governor promised a veto. After a long debate, the House passed a bill to ban loaded firearms on school grounds. And the New Hampshire Motor Speedway gets the green flag on a country music festival. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them in this hour. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. We're also broadcasting a live video of this radio show today, so you can watch at our Facebook page. Again, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization committed to encouraging civic engagement, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Executive Editor of the Union Leader, Trent Spinner. Thank you very much, everybody, for being here. Really appreciate it.
Good morning.
Hey, Peter.
Thanks.
Again, listeners, phone number for you to call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. The New Hampshire House gave preliminary approval to a bill that would legalize recreational marijuana for adults. The legislation would establish a governor-appointed commission to approve and issue licenses for marijuana products in the state, and it would allow for some of those who have marijuana-related convictions to have their convictions expunged. Republican Steve Pearson of Derry, however, voted against the bill to legalize marijuana.
We are not going to solve our drug crisis by legalizing more drugs. That is a fundamentally flawed argument.
That's a Republican, Stephen Pearson of Derry, echoing a familiar sentiment among Republicans. I want to start with you, Anna Brown. How significant is this House vote?
Well, honestly, actually, I don't think that this is a really significant vote. Marijuana legalization passed on a preliminary vote last year as well. So now it has to go to the House Ways and Means Committee. It was after it went to that committee that it died last year. And also, so if we're just talking, this vote was really just, should the bill keep moving forward? And it did not pass with a veto-proof majority. So it was a relatively uncontroversial vote in the way of marijuana legalization. And they didn't have nearly enough to override Sununu's veto, which we know is coming.
Mm-hmm. And so the governor was quick to promise this. So nobody's really surprised. So I'm wondering if you could comment, maybe each of you, on sort of where the conversation is going, where the argument is headed. Because we heard from Stephen Pearson about sort of combating the drug crisis and how this would not help in his view. Proponents of legalizing marijuana have said, okay, it might provide some income. It actually might do the opposite of what Stephen Pearson is saying, which is help people get off more dangerous, addictive drugs. It might be a criminal justice issue. There are a variety of arguments. I'm wondering, maybe, Trent, what do you think? Where's the argument going?
It's sort of the same arguments that we've heard time and time again, right? People are saying, proponents are saying, look, our neighbors want this, and other states around New Hampshire have already legalized it, made it available, and people are going to great lengths to get it, so why not just do it in New Hampshire? We can tax it. But on the other side, the governor put together a commission to study this. It included hospitals, police, health providers of mental health care coverage, and they all found that this was not something that would be good for the general well-being of New Hampshire. So very similar arguments that we're hearing again, very similar action that we saw again in the House. I would imagine that we'd see similar action in the Senate, too, where the Senate has traditionally been opposed to this. And with the governor already vetoing, already promising a veto, and not having enough House votes in the House to override, I would imagine that this is going to kind of be a repeat of history.
Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Trent gave us a fine summary of where the situation is right now. This is one of those issues that public opinion has changed pretty significantly over a number of years, both nationally and regionally and even locally here in New Hampshire, where there are pretty strong majorities in favor of legalization. The whole discussion and debate around not only marijuana but opioids as well over the last 4 or 5 years has really kind of shifted away a bit from a law enforcement issue, and it's increasingly focusing on this nexus of health issues, criminal justice issues, et cetera. And so I've heard Governor Sununu make that argument that he believes that marijuana is a gateway drug to potentially opioid abuse or some other type of illegal drug use. And if that's the case, that's a very difficult opinion to change. And so it's going to come down to a numbers game. At some point, there will be enough people supporting this and a governor who's willing to sign it, and New Hampshire will get it. I think we're headed in that direction. But as long as he's there to veto it, and as Anna was saying, it's not clear that the override vote is there right now. And I think I mentioned on an earlier roundup that some of the Democratic leadership was on the exchange, I think it was last month or so, and even they were a little kind of tentative about the whole concept and how it was going to move forward. So attitudes are changing. Some of the votes are there, but it's just not clear that the legislative votes that they need to override a for sure Sununu veto is going to happen.
Trent, Dean brings up a good point about the numbers changing. If you look at public polling, somewhere between 60 and 70% of New Hampshire residents want some form of legalization. Yeah. And but the problem is that hasn't translated yet into the political world. You saw a Democratic candidate running for governor, Steve Marchand, who made it really one of his main campaign points, and he lost in the primary. So as much as the public, as much as people say they want it, it doesn't appear like people are voting for candidates who support it. The other thing that we have to look at is the presidential primary and how much how many Democrats are going to make this an issue when they're campaigning in New Hampshire. Every single presidential candidate, a major presidential candidate on the Democratic side, has expressed some level of support for legalization. And so I wonder if that makes it more of an issue for people, for local politicians here.
Mm-hmm. Dean, I wanted to put a finer point on something you said,
sure,
which is that we're heading in that direction, the direction of legalization.
Yes.
So is it your opinion that it's sort of a matter of time?
Yeah, I believe it is a matter of time, whether it's going to be a couple years or 10 years. It really depends on having people in place in the legislature, not only to pass it, but to have a governor who's willing to sign it or to have an override. But it's remarkable to me, as someone who's been around for a while, to see how this issue has changed. I mean, there was a time not that long ago where, even admitting that you use marijuana was a disqualification for running for public office. And we're eons away from that now. We have it in Vermont, Maine, and Massachusetts. I really do think it's a matter of time. But as I think Trent made a great point, sometimes on these cultural issues or social issues, you get a little bit of a lag in terms of translating into the number of votes in the legislature. But I think we're moving that way, yeah.
Anna Brown.
The other factor that I think is going on here is that this is a budget year. And so on the one hand, marijuana legalization promises over $30 million in revenue, according to estimates. But on the other hand, it's a really complex debate to be handling when the legislators are very much concerned with the bread and butter issues of funding our government. And so I think a controversial issue like this, it's possible that it'll just get put off until next year. Maybe they'll put it in a study committee or they'll just retain it in committee. And then that big debate will just get put off another year. As Dean said, a matter of time, but probably not this year.
Okay. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. In just a moment, we're going to be talking about education funding. So many pieces of legislation got a little bit of traction in the House this week, having to do with stabilization grants, Keno funding for full-day kindergarten. It's a good time to share your concerns about education funding. How's it going in your community? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Before we get into issues pertaining to public education in the state, though, let's talk about a bill to ban firearms in safe school zones, which passed after a lengthy debate in the House on Wednesday. The bill now goes to the House Criminal Justice Committee for additional review. Supporters say it simply codifies federal gun-free schools acts, but opponents say it's an example of government overreach. And Republican Jack Flanagan of Brookline spoke out against the measure to ban guns in school zones. He argued it would make students less safe.
If I have a gun, I'm picking up my child at school, and I hear gunshots in the school, do I then not go into the school to defend the children there with my legally owned gun?
So that's Jack Flanagan speaking out against the bill that passed, or at least advanced in the House. Dean, it seems like this is another function of Democrats being in control of the legislature, but maybe the governor would put a stop to it.
Yeah, this is a an issue that people are typically really dug in on. There's not a lot of wiggle room in terms of persuading people one way or the other. So it's really, again, a question of who's in control. Democrats obviously were going to push for this. They're trying to do some similar activity in Congress at the national level. But again, the issue would be Governor Sununu, who has been a very strong supporter of gun rights. And, you know, just to kind of demonstrate how difficult an issue this is in terms of persuasion, you know, I encourage listeners to do a thought exercise. Say you're sitting in the auditorium of your child's school watching a musical concert. Do you feel more safe or less safe knowing that some percentage of the parents are carrying concealed weapons? Now, some people are going to feel more safe. Others are going to feel less safe. That's not something that is really persuadable. You feel one way or the other, and that's the problem with this issue and why it's such an intractable issue to really to do anything unless you have the numbers in the legislature and a governor who's willing to sign it.
Anna Brown.
I think one other interesting aspect of this is there was a somewhat less restrictive bill that the House ended up just tabling. And so that would have just let local school districts decide either way to just set any policy related to firearms, ban them outright, maybe allow teachers to have them. And I think that that more incremental approach maybe could have gotten a favorable nod from Sununu because it supported local control. So I think it's a little interesting that the legislature completely sidestepped that because, as Dean said, I think that Sununu will absolutely veto this. But I think they maybe could have gotten through a local control measure.
Mm-hmm. Trent, I don't know if you're familiar with this one, but when it came to the debate as it was unfolding, Representative John Burt of Goffstown got some blowback, I guess, from some comments he made, both the argument he was trying to make and an off-the-cuff comment. Can you walk us through those comments?
Sure. He says he was making a joke about Representative Al Baldessaro, who has been in the, they've served together in the House for a long time, and Representative Burt from Goffstown, who can sometimes be controversial and can sometimes say off-the-cuff things that are maybe a little, can be open to interpretation, I think is a nice way of putting it.
Risky comments, maybe.
Yes, yes. So he made a joke about Representative Baldessaro's tan, and he said that he felt very white today, which House members booed and actually voted to censure him. It was the first or there aren't many censures of House
it's
members.
It's been a while, right? More than
a
decade?
We think the last time was Representative Steve Valancourt in 2012.
Not a decade. Okay.
Yeah, who was upset that he was cut off while speaking and made a Nazi comment towards the speaker. And so he was censured for that, too.
Mm-hmm. And he also made a comment, I can't remember exactly what it was, regarding severe violence towards children, like children would be violently unsafe because of this.
Well, you said that it was
that
I'm
right?
Paraphrasing that the people who supported the ban, the blood of these children would be on their hands.
Oh, right, yeah, and that didn't draw the censure, but it also drew the ire of those who were opposed to that
comment
view.
To make, yeah.
He got booed for that too, which is a pretty. I mean, that's a. You know, that is outside of House decorum usually, so it was interesting to see.
Yeah, and it's sort of not a policy-based question, certainly, but one of those things that sort of speaks to the emotional intensity behind this issue. So speaking of emotional intensity, let's talk about education funding. The House passed a series of bills that seemed to take into consideration a few problems plaguing New Hampshire school districts, declining enrollment, struggling budgets, particularly in towns with low property values. These bills, of course, still have to be reviewed by the House Finance Committee, so not completely passed yet. But so let's talk about these. One of them is House Bill 177, which would stop the phase out of stabilization grants that were designed to help school district budgets by keeping state aid per pupil stable even as enrollment declines. Anna, can I ask you, how helpful would school districts find this particular piece of legislation?
Oh, we're talking millions of dollars here, especially in some of the poorest districts in the state. I think the problem with stabilization grants, though, is the system... It's an old system. They sort of put those in as a Band-Aid measure just so that those school districts wouldn't lose funding while they were working on this new system. And now this Band-Aid has been in place for years, and so they're trying to replace it. So House Bill 177, I think, ideally is another temporary measure. It sort of keeps that funding level for some districts with falling enrollment that might otherwise see less funding.
Mm-hmm. Another bill that advanced a bit was House Bill 184, which would include full-day kindergarten students as part of regular state education funding rather than the current reliance on revenue from Keno. Money from Keno would go into the Education Trust Fund for overall education funding, not necessarily tied to kindergarten. So this sort of undoes a major part of the Keno Garden legislation that passed a few years ago.
I find this really interesting, given how closely we watched the initial compromise to get full-day kindergarten and linking it up to Keno, with the idea being, I think it was $1,100 per pupil for kindergarten, and then any additional money would be distributed as well. And the issue is that Keno has not produced quite the level of revenue that was initially expected. Now, some towns and cities that would have been revenue producers decided not to take Keno. Others are still in the process of deciding. We're going to get another round as we go through town meetings this March. But it is interesting because it speaks to the issue of that Keno is just not producing the revenue yet anyway that they had hoped that would fully fund full-day kindergarten. And so now they're really kind of changing what was the original deal.
Well, and I think it also reflects this debate now that, so the governor introduced the idea that, all right, let's get rid of the Education Trust Fund entirely and just fund everything out of the pool of general fund tax dollars. And so I feel that it relates to that. We've had in New Hampshire this tradition of funding things very specifically from very specific sources. And there's maybe a movement away from that because it can be difficult, because if we're seeing Keno, okay, well, it's not funding what was promised for kindergarten, so the state is having to pick up an extra tab anyway.
Because they guaranteed, I think, the $1,100
yes,
is guaranteed
yes.
no matter what.
Basically, there's a minimum that it's guaranteed, which is more than what kindergarten was getting before, but not as much as they would be if they were treated like grade 1 through 12. And so similar problems also if we're looking at the Fish and Game Department. They're supposed to have very specific funding sources from fees, and it keeps on falling short. Mm-hmm. So the state is maybe moving away from that tradition in education as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, another bill related to stabilization grants, House Bill 709, would replace stabilization grants in 2021 with what would be called fiscal capacity disparity aid. Doesn't quite roll off the tongue, as well as stabilization grants, but that would primarily benefit property poor school districts. Trent, your view, how would this help?
Well, this has been an issue that has been going on since the 1990s, when the Supreme Court in Claremont 1 and Claremont 2 ruled that the state has to adequately fund education. And it has become an ongoing problem because there are actually declining enrollments in most districts throughout the state. Property-rich towns like Derry, Londonderry, Bedford have that tax base to fund education. But places like Claremont and Franklin don't have as, you know, the property values are lower there, so they don't have the same tax base. This would provide basically relief for all those districts. But the question is just that formula, and something that the legislature has been trying to figure out for almost, 20 years.
Also, the question, will property-rich towns be paying more to the state? Because that was originally part of the bill, and amendments got debated to remove that potentially. But it's still, as you said, in committee, it's still going through this process. So I think that there's that question of, would Londonderry and towns like that be paying more?
Mm-hmm. And finally, House Bill 551 would create a school funding commission to review all aspects of education funding with an eye toward the state Supreme Court's Claremont 1 and Claremont 2 rulings in the 1990s that established a state responsibility to adequately fund education. Re-examining, I guess, the impact of Claremont 1 and Claremont 2, lawmakers, at least some of them, feel like this is worth doing. We're going to take a break shortly, but I want to talk to Joe in Derry first. Joe, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. So quickly, just to comment on the recent bill to ban guns on school campuses. One of the Parkland Douglas Stoneman Douglas High School survivors He's been really well known for going on air. He's like a 19-year-old or something like that. He's been really well known, gone on air, saying about how he's so disappointed how law enforcement didn't actually take any action on the school, and that there were, you know, three people who were unarmed who tried to stop the shooter and ended up getting killed. And so, looking at Florida, where they have pretty similar gun laws in New Hampshire, and it's relatively free, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to ban guns in just one part of the state, because if I'm a criminal or a shooter or something like that, it's really, and this is an argument that's used all the time, but it does make sense. We live in New Hampshire, it's really easy to get a firearm. So I think it's pretty pointless banning it there, because if someone's either going to take, you know, some psycho's going to take it from their parents, or, you know, if it's an adult who's a shooter, it's not going to be very difficult for them to get that gun. So, you know, it just seems like virtue signaling, and rather than actual legislation that'll actually solve the issue. Mm-hmm. So that's just my two cents on it.
Well, Joe, we appreciate your comments. Thank you very much for giving us a call. We appreciate it. We try to bring comments in even as we wrapped up the discussion on that particular subject. So thanks again, Joe. Still to come on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, the Union Leader reported this week that the secret list of police officers red flagged for dishonesty or troubling behavior grew. We'll learn about why the UL and other organizations want this list disclosed and why the state does not. And there's a lot more to chat about today. So hit us up. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can also post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, which is where you can watch a live video of this radio program. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. We'll be back on tape on Monday, but we're back live on Tuesday talking about federal taxes. The Republicans' tax overhaul is in full effect this year, and we're looking to see what questions you have about changes this year to your federal taxes. Visit our show page, nhpr.org/exchange, and you'll find a post where you can submit your questions for the show. You can do that now. You can do it this weekend. But right now, we are taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello, and in the studio with me are Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Executive Editor of the Union Leader, Trent Spinner. The Union Leader reported this week that the secret list of police officers red flagged for dishonesty or troubling behavior increased from 171 last summer to 264 now. Trent, the Union Leader, among other news organizations, and the New Hampshire ACLU, suing the state to make this list public. Remind us what this list is.
Right now, if you're arrested, you have a right to understand if there is evidence that could potentially help your case. So if a police officer who arrested you or is going to be testifying against you lied before on the stand or has some sort of disciplinary action where they lied to police or lied to their superior, you have a right to know that because that could potentially help your criminal case. Right now, what happens is the Attorney General's office maintains that list. And if there's a police officer testifying against you in a criminal case, the prosecutor in that case has to check that list. But here's the thing. We don't know who's on the list. Mm-hmm. So unless that prosecutor does his or her job, unless that prosecutor remembers to check the list and accurately checks the list, you could potentially be facing a police officer testifying against you who has lied before or has done something that would potentially help your case. So our argument, along with the ACLU, is that that list should become public, that there should be a check and balance on this government action. And the state says basically that the police officers, that they're that these are personnel files, and that state law currently does not allow these personnel files to be released. And they say that maintaining the secrecy of those personnel files is more important than the public's right to the information. Our argument is that the list itself is not a personnel file. The list itself is just it basically has the name of the police officer, the police department that they are working for, and the reason that they are on that list. Mm-hmm. And so we're arguing that that is not a personnel file. That is a list maintained by the Attorney General's office that is subject to the right to know law.
And Anna, Dean, I would love you to jump in whenever you feel comfortable, because we know Trent has a position here and a stake in the outcome, which we totally respect, but we just want to get to the bottom of that and have your opinions as well. But Trent, I wanted to ask you, why does the Attorney General maintain this list and not say the individual police departments where these officers work?
That's a long story, but okay. Basically, this has been a changing process. So it used to be that the police departments would report it to the county attorneys, but then the problem is, you know, then there are 10 different county attorneys who are maintaining their own list, and it's unclear how to get on the list, how to get if you're a police officer who is accused of dishonesty and it turned out that you didn't lie. How do you get off the list? There was really no process.
So you could, at least in the past, get on this list with just an accusation.
You could get on this list. Well, it was kind of unclear in the past.
Okay.
And so what the new Attorney General, Gordon McDonald, has done is he made it used to be called the Lori list because the Supreme Court there was a case in the Supreme Court. But the Attorney General has basically taken over the process to make it more uniform throughout all the counties.
OK. And do we have any indication why the list grew to 246 from 171 last summer?
No, and that's what we would like to find out when
like
we win this
out.
Lawsuit.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So, Dean, mm-hmm. your thoughts?
Well, you know, I have to be honest. I didn't even know this list existed until I started doing the news roundup, and I think it was in the context of hearing Trent's various battles over public disclosure. You know, I mean, this is something that the lawyers and the officials will figure out, and through the lawsuit. But I would be interested, just a curiosity, to know why there is. That's a pretty big jump, it sounds like, and I'd be interested to know why as well.
You'd be curious, but do you think there is an overwhelming public interest to know this?
I guess I would come down on the side of more disclosure rather than less.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, personnel issues are always thorny, and people, there are a lot of, you know, options you have legally in terms of protecting your privacy.
Yeah.
It's not unusual, the whole concept of a privacy in a personnel file, et cetera. That's pretty common.
Yeah.
And I think there's an argument to be made on the other side that if this list does become public, there may actually be a disincentive to put officers' names on the lists because their superior officers might know that, okay, this is going to have public reputation consequences for anybody who ends up on this list. So they might be actually more likely to disclose potential problems if this list wasn't public. I also think it's worth noting this issue has been largely in the courts going back and forth. As Trent mentioned, it was originally called the Lori list based on a case that included the name Lori. And it's been going back and forth. There is actually legislative action on this. So the House, the Judiciary Committee voted overwhelmingly. They want to pass a bill that would make these records public under the right to know law. So that would just bypass this lawsuit entirely and say, nope, this is out in the public. So I think it's worth keeping an eye on that. It's supposed to be up for a vote next week.
And just to be clear, and to fairly represent the other side, you know, the argument from police is that there are potentially people on this Lori list who have done nothing wrong,
mm-hmm.
and this hurts them if they're
right.
if they're publicly outed being on this Lori list, but they didn't do anything wrong, and there was no clear indication of how they could get off the list. That hurts them, and that hurts their ability to do their job.
Yeah, because let's be clear, this is not criminal behavior that these police officers have undertaken. If they commit a crime, they get convicted of the crime just like anybody else. This is those personnel issues, so not following proper procedures. Maybe there was a sexual harassment complaint. There's another issue that's coming up where two officers were dating each other, and did that impact things when there was an altercation in Manchester? So it's not criminal behavior we're talking about.
The way I've read it described as, and maybe you folks could clarify, is that it flags officers for dishonest and troubling behavior. I mean, those are pretty loaded words. They're not a crime, but
right.
dishonesty and troubling behavior is something to think about, sure.
Yeah. So, Trent, what's the next step for this?
Well, it's going to be a long court battle. I think Anna brings up a good point, which is that if the House passes that, if that legislation passes, that makes this entire thing moot. But yeah, there are going to be several hearings, and I think a long court battle ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch gears and talk about U.S. Senator Maggie Hassan, who criticized a pharmaceutical drug maker during a Senate hearing on Tuesday. Hassan focused her questions on the role the companies played in fueling the opioid crisis. NHPR's Jason Moon did some reporting on this. But during the hearing before the Senate Finance Committee, Senator Hassan focused on sales tactics the companies used when promoting opioids to doctors.
It is hard for me to take the industry's goal here as promoting good health seriously when its behavior to maximize sales of opioids created an epidemic.
So Hassan coming out strong on the drug companies. Anna, your thoughts on Hassan's comments?
Well, I think that it reflects the fact that she's the senator from New Hampshire. That hearing was originally about prescription drug prices, and she kind of made it about the opioid crisis because perhaps that is impacting New Hampshire more. It's worth noting that New Hampshire's attorney general also is suing some of these companies mm-hmm. over their marketing practices, and they are troubling.
Mm-hmm. Dean?
It was interesting. I mean, as we may have noted, this is a Senate Finance Committee hearing on the high price of prescription drugs, but she used this as an opportunity to continue this line of argument. And, you know, there are these lawsuits, the AG and different cities suing about the practices, et cetera. So this is something we've been talking about for a while now and trying to get it at the root of why there's been such availability and such high prescribing in the state. And so it was interesting but not surprising to see her take this tack.
Mm-hmm. We heard this week from Senator Jeanne Shaheen. We'll switch gears now a little bit to 2020. She spoke about a variety of issues on Monday on The Exchange. You can find that in the podcast or at nhpr.org. But she also spoke about who she would endorse in the Democratic primary. And she says she's not going to endorse anyone.
And that includes Elizabeth Warren. It includes Sherrod Brown. It includes Amy Klobuchar, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris. I mean, it's anybody who is coming to New Hampshire. I'm happy to answer questions, provide any assistance that I can, but I'm not going to endorse.
So basically a lot of people she's not going to endorse. Yeah. But Dean, is this fairly common for someone
running? I mean, sometimes people will endorse, but I think in her instance, she can say she needs to focus on her reelection campaign. As I think she rattled off a list of something like five senators in there. So there is some risk to picking one senator, particularly if you pick someone who ends up not doing particularly well. So, you know, it's kind of in keeping with the idea that when you have a large, crowded primary field, the party or the party elders or senior politicians are, in theory, try to stay neutral. But so I was not, you know, for Senator Shaheen, I was not surprised to see her decide to stay out of it.
Trent? This is actually a bigger deal than I think people think. Consider Jeanne Shaheen's tactical knowledge of New Hampshire. She ran Gary Hart's campaign in 1984. She was elected to the state Senate in 1990, governor 1996, 1998, 2000. She knows how to run campaigns in New Hampshire. And just the pure tactical knowledge of how to make it work, of all the little towns and the Democratic chairman for Cheshire County or Westmoreland or something like that. Like, she has decades of connections, 30 years of connections.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem like she was going to withhold that knowledge, just not publicly endorse.
But to have, if you were, Elizabeth Warren, for example, and you had Jeanne Shaheen on your team, that would be a big deal. And for her to say, you know what, I'm going to help everyone and not just focus on one particular person, that person that she would endorse, I think, would have a huge edge over other people. And her not doing that is a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. That is a big, the way you just laid it out, it's that in theory is a big step. But I'm not surprised that she decided not to take that big step.
Yeah, I mean, one thing to remember is we have six senators who have officially declared or formed committees, and there are many other senators that are going to run. I mean, are we going to be talking about one-tenth of the Senate running for president? I mean,
possibly.
That could potentially really alienate some of her colleagues if she stepped in.
And how disastrous would it be for Senator Shaheen if, you know, she does endorse someone and that person doesn't end up winning the primary, and so she has to sort of endorse someone else in the general, and is that an awkward situation for her to be in, or Trent?
It may be. I think it depends on how ugly that race would get, right? I mean, I think that it's politics, and people do what is best for them at the time, and things change. People win elections, people lose elections, and alliances change. So I don't know how disastrous it would be for her in particular. You know, she didn't endorse Donald Trump, and he won in New Hampshire, and that...
no one expected her to endorse Donald Trump.
Of course, but that wasn't disastrous for her. So, you know, I think alliances change in politics.
Well, and these endorsements, these sorts of issues, when, to the extent that they do happen occasionally, where somebody's on the wrong side of a winning candidate, et cetera, you know, it often blows over, and, you know, there's a real premium when you get to the convention phase in the summer of trying to unify the party and let bygones be bygones. And so you would probably see some of that if it were to happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well... On the subject of 2020, California Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell paid a visit to New Hampshire ahead of a potential presidential run. He hasn't made a formal announcement to run yet, but while he was here, he did speak about the economy, stressing that it needs to work for everyone. So, Dean, who is Swalwell? What has he done that might make him a good presidential candidate?
Well, if you watch cable news, CNN, MSNBC, he's on a lot. He'd be a very familiar face to you. He's young. He's from California. He's 39, I believe. I think he has a new child or young kids. So he's somebody who, for people who pay close attention to national politics, is viewed as this kind of young, ambitious, up-and-coming Democrat, probably not well-known at all to the broader electorate. You kind of have to follow sort of congressional politics to know who he is. We've kind of seen this one coming for a long time. He's been talking about possibly doing it. But, you know, this would sort of fit into the idea that you have the sort of younger, we currently have a president who's, what, 72, 73. And, you know, if Joe Biden runs, he's going to be late 70s. Bernie Sanders is late 70s. And so he would be part of the sort of younger cohort. Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of Indiana
mm-hmm.
is even younger. I think he's maybe 37 or 38.
Andrew Yang's pretty young too.
Yeah. So this is sort of at the other end of the age distribution for presidential candidates.
Anna.
It's interesting you bring up Biden and the age factor, because I actually think that the first time Rep Swalwell really started to get newspaper coverage was when Cher, the artist Cher, came out and said that she would like to see a campaign that was Biden for president and Swalwell for vice president.
Oh, interesting.
And he tweeted back saying, I'd be game for that. I'd be up for that. So that's sort of where he got his attention. It's worth noting he's from California. So I think he California's having an earlier primary this year. So that's maybe why he thinks he has a little bit more of a chance, even though a representative has never got the nomination for president.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things he spoke about while he was here was student debt, saying he has about $100,000 of his own student debt. And he suggested that a volunteer service program might be an interesting way to go about helping students with massive debts pay them off. A variety of ideas on that subject, of course. But I'm curious what you think the importance of the student debt issue is going to be this time around in the Democratic primary. Well, maybe we'll start with you, Trent. What do you think? How important is student debt going to be this campaign season?
Well, don't forget that New Hampshire has one of the highest rates of student debt per capita in the country.
So at least important in New Hampshire.
It's very important in New Hampshire. I think it's a reason that Bernie Sanders did so well. I think that was a major issue for him. And one of the things that we're looking at as this primary field kind of coalesces is how many people are going to have general support, and how many people are single issue candidates who are just looking to raise their profile or looking to raise the profile of their issue. And so there's only a certain amount of support in the Democratic primary. Like, there's a pool of money and it will be split among people who are running. And when we're looking to kind of determine how much coverage we give to each person, with potentially 30 people running in the primary, one of the things we're really looking at is how widespread is that support, and how many people are just really looking to raise their profile? You know, people who don't have that general support, people who don't have the money to really make a serious campaign.
And student debt is one of those issues that I've watched shift pretty dramatically in the last several presidential elections. You know, there were several cycles ago, the discussion was all about, taking care of the problem of predatory student loan debt. And then the next cycle was, maybe debt-free college. And then Bernie Sanders came in with free public university. And so there are going to be these kinds of discussions about the ways in which you can help students with debt. But in some sense, the big ticket item that everyone's going to discuss is whether or not to have free tuition for public schools.
Mm-hmm. One last thing to mention on the subject of 2020. When Democratic Senator Kamala Harris came to New Hampshire late last month, she was questioned by two reporters about her campaign strategy. In their questions, they cited concerns by quote, some people that Harris was leaving New Hampshire out of her plans for the most part. She got two questions like that. And then later on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, she spoke about what she believes was behind those comments.
Yesterday, I was in New Hampshire. And when I was there, the reporters, the first line of questioning I got was, you're in New Hampshire. We heard you're not going to come to New Hampshire. We thought you weren't going to try and compete in New Hampshire. And what no one said, but the inference was, well, the demographic of New Hampshire is not who you are in terms of your race and who you are. And I was like, no, I am competing in New Hampshire. I'm going to be here.
So Kamala Harris saying she's going to be here, but sort of interpreting comments from some of New Hampshire's press corps. Trent, your thoughts?
This is one of the biggest criticisms of the New Hampshire primary that is heard that other states make, that New Hampshire is something like 95% white. And that is a question that I know I've asked presidential candidates going back all the way to 2004, 2008. And it's a question that we ask a lot. We ask pretty much our first line of questioning is, are you going to run for president and are you going to make a play in New Hampshire? So I'm not sure there was a racial undertone to those questions. It's a standard question that we ask. But it is an interesting criticism of New Hampshire and the primary and the demographics here.
Mm-hmm. Anna, what do you think?
Well, I think it's worth noting also that there is a lot more racial diversity among candidates this year. Mm-hmm. Senator Cory Booker, former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro. So among other candidates who have not yet declared. So I think that it's her inference about it being racial undertones. I'd agree with Trent. I think that this is more just New Hampshire is always going to ask, are you coming to New Hampshire? Yeah. Do you still care about us? Do we still matter? But yes, it is an incredibly white state. And we can argue that, you know, we're politically diverse. We're more civically engaged. But there are certain issues that I think it's good for her to bring that up because it's probably not going to get debated as much in New Hampshire town halls.
Okay. Dean.
Yeah. You know, the issue for her is that all of the political analysis, punditry, conventional wisdom said for some time leading up to her entrance into the race that, well, you know, she could come to New Hampshire. New Hampshire's, you know, 95 or 96% white. If she finishes third or fourth or even fifth, that would be okay because she'll go on to South Carolina. South Carolina, a majority African-American vote in the primary. She can go on to Nevada, which is much more diverse. California is not that far behind. So she really got put in that position because so many people were running these scenarios in which that is one path for her to the nomination. It's not really about anything that she did or did not do. It's just that stuff was all developing in advance on, you know, Twitter and talk radio and cable news. And so it was waiting for her when she got here. But that had been the argument, as then I've heard several analysts say, well, she can do mediocre in New Hampshire because South Carolina is a majority African-American primary vote and Nevada is diverse and California's right down the road after that. So there is some implication there. But it is true that we also ask that of everybody. We like to have everybody here.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones and talk to Representative Michael Cahill from Newmarket. He's a Democrat, and we're going to switch gears a little bit to hear from Representative Cahill on the subject of education legislation. Thank you very much for calling, Representative.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call. I was in the car, and I heard you talking about the other important education funding bills that we've passed, but I'm mm-hmm. concerned that they may not survive a veto, and you know, because they in fact really with taxes. But there's another important bill that failed in committee and on the floor yesterday. This was put some money into school building aid, something we haven't done for 10 years. And I think that few people know that we have a 9% tax on rooms and meals, but we don't know that the business operator gets 3% commission for collecting it. That was $9 million last year. We're literally leaving money on the table, and you know, we can't afford to do that. We have very few taxes, and that money really should be spent for the public good. Now, I want to put it into school building aid because my town spending $39 million renovating two schools, and, you know, it's all on the property tax there. Mm-hmm. This has happened in several other communities, and it needs to be addressed, and the legislature has punted so far. And this is one place, it's just a little money under the cushion, and we can make a big difference if we just make that change. A $100 cap would have brought us $6 million last year, and $6 million is a lot more than we put into it in the last 10.
Well, Representative Cahill, thank you very much for bringing this to our attention. You know, we do give some attention to bills that did make it through, but point taken, people do care about some of these bills that didn't make it so far. So thank you very much for bringing that up. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. Still to come, the Supreme Court of New Hampshire says the New Hampshire Motor Speedway can host a country music festival, even though neighbors of the Loudoun Track challenged whether such a festival was permissible under an agreement the Speedway signed years ago with the town. We'll speak with Nick Stoico of the Concord Monitor about this story. But what do you think? Good thing for Loudoun? Not so good? Good for the state? The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We've got a live video broadcast of this radio program there as well, NHPR Exchange on Facebook. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. You trust the journalists you hear on NHPR because you know they follow a strong code of ethics. You know that they're working in your interest. The people who use this service are the most important single source of support for this service. Your $10 a month gift fuels this award-winning station that keeps you and your neighbors across New Hampshire in the know. Become a sustaining force for NHPR. Give today at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Trent Spinner, executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Anna Brown, director of research and analysis at Citizens Count. We're talking about the week's news, and we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. On Monday, the state Supreme Court ruled unanimously in favor of the New Hampshire Motor Speedway in a dispute with neighbors over a proposed country music festival. And joining us now to talk about this story is Concord Monitor reporter Nick Stoico. Nick, thank you very much for being with us.
Morning, Peter. Thank you for having me.
So, Nick, before we get into the Supreme Court's ruling, can you remind us how we ended up in this moment? What was the dispute?
Well, you have to go back, I guess, first to 1989, when it was right after the time that Bob Baer had purchased Breyer Motorsports Park before it was New Hampshire Motor Speedway, and with the plan of expanding it. And some neighbors had some concerns about this, as well as a few members of the Loudoun Planning Board. So they got together and put together this sort of agreement that the track agreed to as well, that it would only be, you know, certain times for racing would be allowed. If there were to be concerts, it could only be held in conjunction with racing. And that was the agreement at the time. Several years pass, almost 30 years pass, comes up to 2017 when the track announces it has plans to hold a country music festival. This was shortly after the track had announced that it was losing its fall September NASCAR race. For years, it had two NASCAR races, going back to the early 90s, and in 2017 it announced it would be losing that fall race. So shortly after that, the track said it was going to be having this country music festival in the summer, and these neighbors came back out holding this agreement from 1989 saying that it would be a violation of that, and that's how we ended up in court over this.
And Nick, the neighbors were worried about what specifically? Were they worried about noise, about traffic, about destruction of roads for frequent use, all of the above?
Yeah, I think it was all of the above, and really just kind of going back to saying, hey, you know, we agreed to, you know, this deal back then, and in their view, the track was violating that agreement. So that was really sort of the crux of the issue, again, that, you know, led to ending up in court over this.
Mm-hmm. And the track, likewise, was worried about a significant loss of revenue, and that's why they were trying to find something to maybe replace or supplement the other things they're doing there, yes?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, when I've asked about this, they won't say that it's directly, the track won't say that this is directly supposed to replace that fall race. They also have another sort of undercard NASCAR series that comes through in the fall now as well. But this is certainly in line with their overall plans to expand the use of that space and that track. I mean, I think it's the largest sports venue in New England in terms of acreage. So they've always had plans to sort of expand the use of that. You see it at other
Speedway Motorsports is the parent company, and you see this happening at a lot of their other tracks around the country as well. So it's not by any means unusual for New Hampshire to be trying this when a lot of other tracks are as well. So, but hey, yes, again, the neighbors basically came out and said, hey, we agreed to this, and this would be a violation of it, and the courts said otherwise.
What did they say specifically? Was it illuminating in any way?
I'm sorry?
What did the court say specifically other than this agreement doesn't apply
so
in this
the
case?
Court, right. So the court, so first the Superior Court ruled and then the Supreme Court upheld their ruling that the agreement from the late 80s was restricted only to the space that the Speedway had at the time. In the mid-90s, Bob Baer purchased land to the south of the Speedway and expanded the overall land just southward and opened up several parking lots down there. And it's in that southern end where they plan to hold this music festival. So the Speedway's argument was that it's not a violation of that agreement because the agreement at the time was only restricted to that area that the Speedway was in. Mm-hmm. So the court agreed with that argument, and it was ruled as so by the Superior Court. The neighbors appealed to the Supreme Court, and then, as you mentioned, this week we learned that the Supreme Court had decided to uphold that decision.
And so how did the neighbors in Loudoun respond to the state Supreme Court's decision?
I mean, obviously they were disappointed. You know, they're accepting the decision, of course. It doesn't seem that there's really anywhere that they can go from here with it. Mm. So obviously they're disappointed. As one neighbor that I spoke with said, you know, you win some, you lose some, and this is where we are.
Yeah. So the festival happening later this year, what should we expect to see?
Yeah. So I asked Dave McGrath that Dave McGrath is the executive vice president, general manager of the track, and he couldn't give a precise date of when this is going to start. He said ideally it would be this summer, but that is up in the air. No decisions have actually been made at this point, but they're working towards maybe having one this summer. If not, it would start in 2020.
Okay,
summer 2020.
So starting next year. All right. Well, Nick Stoiko, reporter for the Concord Monitor, thanks very much for coming on the show and sharing your insights. We really appreciate your reporting.
Yeah, thank you, and have a great weekend.
You too. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. Give us a call if you have a question or comment about the week's news, 1-800-892-6477. This week, executives from Sig Sauer, a New Hampshire-based company, were in court in Germany over charges that the company illegally funneled weapons from Germany to Colombia through New Hampshire. CEO Ron Cohen and two other executives were in the hot seat. NHPR's Todd Bookman had reported on this, that Cohen would receive a 22-month suspended prison sentence, fines topping $1 million. That's according to German media. He was facing up to 5 years in prison if found guilty. Trent, the union leader, was following this story as well. What do you make of this? What does this mean for Sig Sauer in New Hampshire?
It's a funny story because this was actually a deal brokered by the Obama administration. Basically, what happened was those guns were made in Germany. They were brought to New Hampshire, and then they were sold to Colombia. But that's not a deal that you can just, like, Sig couldn't just decide to do that on their own. There has to be federal government involvement to broker that deal.
And my understanding was that they could have done it if they could have made the guns here in New Hampshire and gone right to Colombia, right? But because they had to make it in Germany, and Germany
they didn't have
has
the capacity.
Some prohibition. Yeah.
Exactly. So, it's 100% legal if those guns had been made in New Hampshire. But because they were made in Germany, there are German laws preventing that sale. And so because the guns ended up in Colombia, that was actually a crime in Germany. And so those executives were, as you said, in the hot seat.
So there's a fine, there's a 22-month suspended prison sentence, and then that's it.
That's
Sig Sauer goes on with life?
Goes on with life. And this has become a bigger and bigger part of Sig's business, is government contracts, providing weapons to the military. You know, you can get a Sig Sauer weapon at any gun store in New Hampshire, but this has really become the vast majority of their business, those government contracts and providing weapons to militaries across the planet.
Other stories we've been reporting on this week at NHPR, a new work requirement for some people who receive health insurance through the state's expanded Medicaid program goes into effect today. Those people now have 75 days to figure out how they can satisfy the new monthly work requirement. June will be the first month that beneficiaries are required to submit their hours to the state, and if they fall short, they could lose their health coverage. Also, a proposal to change how New Hampshire draws its political districts cleared its first big hurdle yesterday. The bill would take the power to draw those lines out of the hands of the legislature and give it to an independent redistricting commission. And House Democrats passed a business tax hike yesterday that they say will bring in additional money to fund state services. The bill would reverse a tax cut that goes into effect this year and cancels another round of tax cuts scheduled for 2021. Republicans, including the governor, are criticizing the move. Also, wanted to ask the folks here around the table about Mount Tecumseh, which has always barely made the 4,000-footer list at 403 feet. Actually, there's been a resurvey of this, and it's actually 3,995 feet. So 5 feet short. Very sorry. Trent, I understand you are the only hiker around the table here. So how much of a bummer is this for hikers?
So I'm about a quarter of the way into the 4,000-footers in New Hampshire. It's a big deal for people who are committed to doing this. And it's funny. Sometimes you'll be at the top of a mountain and you'll run into people. One time I was at the top of, I forget where I was, and, you know, I was all sweaty and I had been up early and I was tired. And Senator Jeb Bradley just walked by, kind of strolling on. So it's a real serious hobby for people in New Hampshire. I would imagine that I'm still going to have to do Tecumseh because people who have already completed the 48, I just don't think they're going to let me in the club if I only do 47.
So you're gonna do it even though it's not a 4,000 footer.
Yes.
You can't just stack like 5 feet of rocks at the top.
You know what? I'm going to do that and take a picture.
All right, cool. So we fixed the problem. Awesome. Another thing related to the outdoor climbing lifestyle, I guess that's hiking, but this is climbing, right? The documentary Free Solo took the best documentary Oscar this past weekend. It follows Alex Honnold, a young man considered to be the best rock climber in the world by some, and he makes what's considered to be an impossible climb up El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. The climb was significant because it was done without ropes or equipment. If you see pictures of this, it makes me nervous to even look at the pictures. I don't know if you guys have seen these, but it's pretty terrifying. But anyway, I bring it up because Matt Renner, according to the Seacoast Online, grew up in Durham, attended Oyster River Schools, and he's the executive producer of Free Solo. So that's kind of a pretty cool connection. Has anyone here seen the film?
I haven't seen it, but my brother's a professional rock climber and has climbed that with ropes.
Yeah.
And he shared photos, so he actually like slept on the side of it. And some of the photos that he shared almost made me want to vomit.
Yeah, it's super scary.
Yeah, 60 Minutes did a piece on Alex the climber that is hard to watch because you know there's nothing holding him on the side of the cliff.
Yeah, just how he manages fear, I think, is a really interesting thing. Yeah. Worth mentioning here that Mark Sinnott, author from Jackson, New Hampshire, wrote about Alex Honnold in his new book. It's called The Impossible Climb. It covers Honnold's path to climbing El Cap as well as climbing culture. I'm speaking with Mark Sinnott tonight about that book on the bookshelf from NHPR. You can find that during All Things Considered and a longer version of the interview on the podcast. Just search for the bookshelf from NHPR wherever you get your podcasts. We've got to wrap up there. We've successfully rounded up a week's worth of news. I want to thank all our guests for being here. Anna Brown from Citizens Count, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis, ever-present guest from SNHU. Thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
That's it for today. But remember, the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our public radio fellow is Ali Oshinsky. Rebecca Lavoie is working the cameras today. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.